Well, I have to tell you that one of my favorite times in school growing up was story time. Story time was always my favorite time, particularly
if our teacher was good at telling stories in exciting ways, with a lot of emphasis and a lot of hand gestures to draw me in. I loved story time. And that's sort of what we've got today, is story time. Story time from the Bible, story time from current events, story time even from our church as we look back in our church's history. And the importance of stories, stories can inform, stories can entertain, but stories can also inspire. And that's actually what I expect the Lord to do through Bible story time today, is that we would be inspired by stories of how God's power is at work in surprising ways, bringing men, women, and children into saving faith of Jesus Christ through some of the most unlikely circumstances imaginable. What I wanted to do first is start by giving you a little story time from our church. Now, our church as we know it today is just about 4 years old, not quite 4 years old. So if you're thinking about a little child, we're a toddler church right now, trying to kind of make our way, getting into things we shouldn't get into, trying to crawl on the cabinets, all of that. That's the toddler phase that we're in as a church. The first 2 years as a church, we were just trying to survive the merger, right? We had two churches coming together and trying to figure out how do we do life together. It was awesome and it was wild. And we did lots of really cool outreach into the community through our garden, through our clothing closet, through our partnerships with local schools. It's a really exciting time. Then, year three, it became a really challenging time. It's like spiritual warfare popped up everywhere. We had all kinds of struggles within our church, within different leaders' families. We were just struggling. So 2024 became a year of survival. Like, hey, let's just make it. To the point where by the end of the year, we were like, hey, let's just celebrate the fact that we're still here. It was all celebrate survival. That became a mantra of us in 2024. Now, we're actually going to tell a story today of a ship that's going to be hit with waves and a huge storm. And let's use that analogy for a second. If a huge storm hits a ship, you've heard the phrase, all hands on deck, right? When a storm comes, everyone has to stop whatever else they're doing and just help the ship survive, right? Rowing, grabbing the mast, trying to make sure that everyone is at their stations. Well, that's a little bit like what our church was like in 2024. If you're a leader of our church, you know that was a cool time to see the Lord's power helping our church through some really challenging times. But after you're all hands on deck rowing to save your life for a long period of time, you get tired, right? So at the end of 2024, as we got into 2025 last year, we realized, whew, we're all a little tired as church leaders. And so in 2025, we said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a year of rest. That was the theme of 2025, year of rest. So we're going to focus on prayer. We're going to focus on community groups and loving one another. But all of the, you know, big outward-facing things that we've been doing through the church, through the course of our church's history, we're going to tone that down a little bit and really emphasize rest. And by God's grace, it has been a sweet blessing to our church leaders. That was 2025. As we started to look into 2026, though, we said, what we don't want to happen is this time of rest to lead to a time of apathy, where we stop caring about our local community. And so, for over a year now, we've said, hey, we want in 2026 for it to be a year focused on outreach. So, here we are, 2026, first Sunday of the year, and we're going to start talking about outreach and how we can love our neighbors well in this new year. As you see from the screen behind me, we're going to be looking at the story of Jonah. And in the book of Jonah, what we see is that we have one of the Bible's worst evangelists possible. Now, what's an evangelist? An evangelist is someone who tells people about the good news of God and what he's doing in the world. Now, Jonah does that. He tells the good news, but he does it in a horrible, horrible way, right? He's bumbling through everything. So one of the encouragements that I hope all of us will draw from is if God can use Jonah, he can definitely use you. All right, because we're going to see Jonah really is kind of a bumbling fool in this story. But you know what the cool thing is? And this tells us so much about the gospel. Guess who wrote the book? Jonah. So Jonah is not scared to tell on himself. He writes his autobiography in a way that does not make him look good. And yet, God's power is on display everywhere. So, if God can use Jonah, he can use you, and he can use me. And even as I, myself, am kind of recovering from a little bit of a cold, and I might be coughing through this a little bit, if God can use Jonah, he can use you. If God can use Jonah, he can use me today. Now, excuse me, back to the church, back to our church's story. Now, we said 2025 was a year of rest, and now we're into a year of outreach. Now, by God's grace, we have even, as 2025 was closing up, we were having some multiple opportunities, even as the year closed, to kind of start getting ahead of the curve, getting ahead of ourselves, and starting to, the Lord just sort of put a lot of different opportunities in our laps, caring for folks as SNAP benefits went away for a time. We were able to get more involved in food relief in the city, and even, as you probably are aware of, even in Jamaica. So, great news. We heard from the church in Jamaica, and they let us know that all the food items clear and the relief items cleared customs on Friday. They got to the church, and the video behind us, if it buffers, they sent us a video of the church members receiving and starting to take inventory on the supplies. So we'll give it like 5 seconds to see if it buffers. If not, we'll find a way to send that out via social media later, which is probably what we're going to need to do. But be encouraged. The items got there, and as I share that to you, I share that so you'll know, first of all, that you know all of your monies, your efforts, the supplies that you and others provided, it's made its way to its intended place. We can pray for them now as they seek to share with their local community. Now, two key things as we think about how not just we as a church, but we as individuals can do outreach in 2026. Two key beliefs that we really need to be focused on. Oh, that's funny. It is playing from my local computer, which is awesome. Two key outreach beliefs. One, we need to believe that God is powerful to save. We have to believe that God is powerful to save. Have you ever been on or seen or watched a sports team and you can just tell they do not believe in themselves? You know, maybe they're coming in to face the national champions and they're like in a low division. They come out on the court, they come out in the field, and they're like, you know what, we don't have a chance. All right? If you don't believe in your mission, you're not going to give it your all. And so one of the things that we need to do as Christians is to really believe in our core, from the bottom of our hearts, that God is powerful to save. And so as he asks us to partner with him, we need to believe that he's powerful enough to do a good work even through us. And that's the second part. We need to believe that God will use us. Yes, are we messy? Are we broken? Are we sinful? Are we discouraged? Yes, 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 we're messy. And yet, God uses messy people like Jonah, like me, and like you, every single day to accomplish his work. All right, so we talked a little bit about our church's history. Let's continue story time, though, by talking about the story of Jonah. And the first thing I want to see, you know, I realized as I was studying through the book of Jonah to prepare the sermon today, I realized how much I got wrong about Jonah growing up. All right, because I grew up in the church and I heard the story, you know, Jonah and the whale is one of the best kids' stories, right? Because, you know, it's such an intense and exciting and short story. So I knew all about Jonah and the whale growing up, or Jonah and the big fish. But I realized that I got so much of the story wrong. So I want to share some of my misperceptions, because perhaps they were yours as well, as we see this amazing story, how God saves the sailors. God saved the sailors. That's actually Jonah chapter 1. The word of the Lord came up from Jonah. Get up, go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because their evil has come up before me. Jonah, who's a prophet of God, right? He's God's man. God tells him to go to Nineveh. He goes to Tarshish. All right, so that would be kind of like someone in telling you, hey, I need you to go to Myrtle Beach, and you start heading to Asheville. Okay, completely opposite direction. All right, Jonah is fleeing from the Lord's presence. All right, verse 4, but the Lord threw a great wind into the sea. Such a great storm arose on the sea that the ship threatened to break apart. Sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his God. They threw the ship's cargo into the sea to lighten down the load. Now, we'll pause here for a second. You notice chapter 5 says, they were all afraid, and each cried out to his own God. These are pagan sailors. These are not kind of God's chosen people. These are not Israelites. These are folks from all over. It's probably a ragtag group. And so they all had their own gods that they were crying out to. Now, their cries didn't work. All right? Now, I think one of the things, because you might know what's going to happen, and a little later, spoiler alert, the sailors kind of throw Jonah overboard. And so I think because I knew as a kid that Jonah is supposed to be sort of like the hero, I thought, man, the sailors are kind of the bad guys, right? Jonah, yeah, he's misguided, but he's still God's prophet. Sailors are the bad guys. Jonah's the good guy, just kind of a little wayward here. It's actually completely the opposite. The sailors are doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Jonah's not. They're fulfilling their call. Jonah's not. He's a prophet. He's not prophesying. They're sailors. They're sailing, and they're doing their work. Not only that, but these were pagan men of faith who were actually going to their God, crying out to help. What's Jonah doing? He's in a deep sleep at the bottom of the vessel. Verse 6, the captain approached him and said, oh, thank you, man. Appreciate it. The captain approached him and said, what are you doing sound asleep? Get up. Call out to your God. Maybe this God will consider us, and then we won't perish. Come on, the sailors said to each other. Let's cast lots. Then we'll know who is to blame for the trouble they're in. So they cast lots, and the lot singled out Jonah. Then they said to him, tell us, who is to blame for this trouble we're in? What is your business? And where are you from? What is your country? Where are you people? What people are you from? He answered, I'm a Hebrew. I worship the Lord God, the God of the heavens, who made the sea and the dry land. So one of the things you need to know that in pagan times, most of the gods were local gods. They were smaller gods. You might call them a demigod. These were gods of a certain region. So all the sailors are crying out to their local gods, right? Small g god. And here, Jonah identifies himself as, I am praying not to this God or this God. I am praying to the God of all creation who made the dry land and who made the sea. So even as he describes who his God is, he is saying this is something much bigger, someone much bigger, which explains verse 10. Verse 10, the men were seized by great fear and said to him, what have you done? This great God, so much greater than any of the gods that we serve, You've gone against him. You're fleeing from him. You've disobeyed him. So they're terrified. What have you done? The men knew he was fleeing from the Lord's presence because he had told them. So they said to him, what should we do to you so that the sea will calm down for us? The sea was getting worse and worse. So Jonah knows. He says, pick me up and throw me into the sea, so that it will calm down for you, for I know that I'm to blame for this great storm that is against you. Now, again, I grew up thinking, sailors, bad guys. Jonah, the good guy. Actually, even when he tells the sailors how they can be saved, because the ship's going down, they know this. The ship's going down, they're all going to die. He says, sacrifice me and you'll be saved. They say no. These pagans, these non-Israelites, these men who you would expect, I mean, they're sailors. Like, you know, sailors, even in current times, don't always have the best reputation in terms of, like, holiness, right? You say, oh, that person's, you know, he's got a mouth like a sailor, right? It's kind of a rough and tumble. I'm not criticizing any sailors or family of sailors. We're saying their rep isn't always like the most godly reputation. And yet these sailors, pagan sailors, they're acting more godly than even Jonah is. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they couldn't because the sea was raging against them more and more. And again, verse 14. So they called out to, who do they call out to? Not their pagan god anymore. They've been praying to their pagan gods, the local deities. But now that Jonah, this is kind of his first time to be an evangelist. Terrible evangelist. The reason he's able to evangelize them is because he put all of them in danger. Because he was selfish. He didn't want to do something, and so he put the life of every man on this ship in danger. And so, because he's been cornered, he didn't even confess once the ship was going. They had to cast lots. He was caught. You know the difference from someone who voluntarily confesses. That's one thing. But someone who's caught in their lie and in their crime, that's another thing. He was caught. And because of this, he gets to evangelize to these people. The world's worst evangelist. The Bible's worst evangelist. But you see, it's starting to take root. Despite the fact that Jonah is a wreck, despite the fact that he's a sinner, he's selfish. We later find out he's racist, by the way. We'll get to that. Despite that, they start to believe in his God. Verse 14. Please, Lord, don't let us perish because of this man's life, and don't charge us with innocent blood. For you, Lord, have done just as you plead. They believe that God, that Jonah's God, not their God, that Jonah's God was the one who brought the storm. You've done as you pleased. Picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea stopped its raging. The men were seized by a great fear of the Lord. That phrase, fear of the Lord, that is a phrase that describes the people of God. They received not only, hear this, they not only were saved from death at the sea, but they were saved spiritually as well because of how God used this messed up, foolish, selfish, racist prophet, Jonah. He saved them not only from physical danger, but spiritual danger as well. The men were seized by great fear of the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. God saved the sailors. God is powerful to save. We need to see this in our lives. We need to see the ways in which God, in fact, is powerful to save. I want to tell you of another story. This is a story of a modern day person, which will continue to illustrate the power of our God, who is powerful to save. This is a story of a man named Yasser Eric. And by the way, if you want to hear more about Yasser Eric or the next individual, the young lady that I'm going to tell you about later on in this sermon, you can go to Christianity Today. These are some of their stories that they're highlighting, testimonials. I'm going to read you a summary that was written of Yasser Eric's story. Yasser Eric grew up immersed in a rigid Islamist environment where identity, purpose, and belonging were tightly bound to religious ideology, Islamic religious ideology. From a young age, he was taught that Islam was not merely a personal faith, but a comprehensive system governing every aspect of life, social, political, moral. Christians in particular were portrayed as dangerous, corrupt, and enemies of truth. The worldview was reinforced daily through family instruction, community norms, and religious teaching. And by the way, as I speak of this man growing up in a militant Islamist context, I think we all are aware that not every person growing up as a Muslim experiences these same teachings or hold these same beliefs, but it was the case for Yasser Eric. As Yasser matured, his commitment to this ideology deepened. He became actively involved in Islamist movements, believing he was serving God by opposing Christianity and Western influence. His sense of righteousness was rooted in obedience and zeal, leaving little room for doubts or compassion towards outsiders. In this environment, questioning inherited beliefs was unthinkable, and it would have been spiritually dangerous. However, despite this outward confidence, cracks in his belief system slowly began to form. Yasser encountered Christians whose behavior contradicted everything he had been taught. Instead of fear, hatred, and retaliation, he saw in these particular individuals humility, patience, and forgiveness, especially from believers who had suffered because of Islamist hostility. One Christian in particular, who Yasser had helped to oppress, continued to pray for Yasser rather than to respond with resentment. This response was unsettling to Yasser, and it introduced an internal struggle he could not easily dismiss. Why would someone love and pray for his enemy? The moral beauty of forgiveness conflicted with the harsh certainty of his ideology. As Yasser wrestled with these questions, he was gradually exposed to the message of Jesus. Unlike the distant, demanding image of God that he had known, Jesus appeared personal, sacrificial, and merciful. The concept of grace, unearned forgiveness, offered even to enemies, challenged the core assumptions of Yasser's belief system. Now, conversion did not come easily. Accepting Christ meant facing profound risks, rejection from family, loss of community, and even threats to personal safety and the collapse of his former identity. His struggle was both spiritual and psychological, marked by fear, guilt, and uncertainty. Ultimately, Yasser reached a breaking point. He recognized that the truth and love he saw embodied in Christians, and especially revealed in Christ, could not be fully explained away. In a decisive step of faith, he turned to Jesus, surrendering the life he had built for one defined by grace. That's the story of Yasser Eric. And this goes to show, just like we read about in the book of Jonah, God's commitment, his desire, his intent to save his people, even from circumstances that you would not ever think possible. God saves the sailors in the story of Jonah. God saves Yasser Eric in modern times. But let's now return to the book of Jonah, and let's see how not only is God willing to save the sailors, but he's also going to save Jonah too. Verse 17. Now, Jonah has been pitched overboard. He's in the water, in the middle of the sea, in the middle of a storm. Now, here's another misconception I had growing up. I heard about the story of Jonah, and in that story, the big fish, which was always described as a whale, the big fish was the bad guy in the story. The big fish was the thing that was dangerous coming to destroy Jonah. But actually, if you read the story carefully, the big fish is not the bad guy. The big fish is the good guy that God used to save Jonah from the bad guy, the storm. So many misconceptions. Verse 17, the Lord appointed, he appointed a great fish. God appointed. He took this great fish from wherever it was, the bottom of the sea, and placed his hand upon the fish, appointed him, selected him, guided him, sent him, directed him to not destroy, but to save Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. One of the things I love about the story is that God saves people in multiple ways. The sailors, for example, they were going to physically die if the storm didn't stop, right? If Jonah was not pitched overboard, that they would have all physically died. But God in his grace and mercy, depths of mercy, as Terrence told us about, in his depths of mercy, God not only saved them physically, but saved them spiritually as well as he revealed himself to them. Same thing with Jonah. Jonah needs to be saved from physical danger. He's going to drown. He's going to die. God saves him from the physical danger. But even more so, he saves him from the spiritual danger of Jonah's rebellion. Now, you might be thinking, oh, but Jonah's a prophet, right? He's spiritually safe. No, there are many prophets in the Bible who come to a very bad end. Just because Jonah's a prophet, that does not save him from spiritual danger. He's headed in a bad direction. His sin and rebellion is going to kill him if God doesn't save him. And so guess what he does? God gives Jonah the gift of 3 nights in the belly of the fish. I've been thinking about this concept a lot over the past couple days. Now, I don't want to make too much of this because the Bible doesn't seem to make too much of this. But I got to tell you something. In the midst of the chaos and the busyness, a lot of fun, a lot of good things, but the chaos and the busyness of the Christmas and New Year's holidays, where you guys didn't feel this way last week. You're like, what day is it? Is it Tuesday? Is it Saturday? I don't know. Like, everything just kind of blends together, and you don't know what you're supposed to be doing, where you're supposed to get up different days. It's just kind of confusing, nonstop chaos. All of a sudden, I thought, now don't get me wrong, I don't want to be in 3 days in the belly of a fish, but 3 days to sit quietly with the Lord. It's kind of a gift. Jonah needed this. And we see how significant it was because the Jonah that went into the fish and the Jonah that came out of the fish are two different people. His prayer, we see this in Jonah chapter 2. Jonah prayed to the Lord, his God, from the belly of the fish. He says, I called out to the Lord in my distress, and he answered me. I cried out to help from deep inside Sheol. You heard my voice when you threw me into the depths, into the heart of the sea. Your current overcame me. All your breakers and your billows swept over me. And yet I said, I have been banished from your sight. Yet I will once again look towards your holy temple. Even though Jonah is in the belly of a fish, in the belly of the sea, no rescue in sight, he shows a first-time faith in God that he has shown yet in this book. Despite everything he can see, he is trusting the Lord for his salvation yet to come. Verse 5, the waters engulfed me to the neck. The watery depths overcame me. The seaweed was wrapped around my head. I sank to the foundations of the mountain. The earth gates shut behind me forever. Then you raised my life from the pit, O Lord my God. That phrase, you raised my life from the pit, Lord my God. He's saying this when he's still in the belly of the well. Do you get that? Like Jonah, by God's grace, has a gift of eyes that are spiritual eyes to see what his physical eyes can't see. I mean, his physical eyes can't see anything. He's in the belly of a fish in the depths of the sea. Supernaturally protected by God. And yet, he is willing to say through eyes of faith, you have already raised my life from the pit, my Lord and my God. You reflect on your life for a minute. And by the way, that's kind of how we're going to close today, is by in a few moments, just getting you to reflect a little bit about your own life and the stories of salvation that you've experienced. But have you ever been in an experience like Jonah, where there is nothing in your circumstances that you can point to say, here's the Lord's salvation? My wife and I were recently talking about the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, we've referenced here many times, and he was a German pastor who was leading resistance against Hitler during the Nazi regime. He is thrown in prison, and at the very end of the war, when salvation's coming, he dies before he's released. And in the middle of the German concentration camp, there is nothing that Bonhoeffer can see through natural eyes that would show him the salvation of God. And yet somehow, we know this because of his writings, attest the fact that he had spiritual eyes to see what his physical eyes couldn't. He believed, despite the fact, like Jonah, that all that he could see around him was death, and yet he saw life because God gave him spiritual eyes to see. God saves Jonah, but he also saves Nineveh. We'll just cover this really quickly. Jonah 3 says, the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. Get up, go to the great city of Nineveh and preach the message that I will tell you. What does verse 3 say? Jonah got up and he went, not to Tarshish, but to Nineveh. The Jonah that went into the whale, into the big fish, it's very different than the Jonah that came out. Because God saved Jonah in this story. And not only that, but God saves Nineveh. We're going to fast forward through the story. Jonah does, in fact, go to this great city of Nineveh. And I alluded to the fact that Jonah was racist. One of the reasons we know this is because Nineveh is the great city in Assyria that is persecuting Jonah's people. It's a different ethnic group, and they're coming in and persecuting his people. And so all of the hatred from receiving that persecution and oppression is boiling up in Jonah. That's why he doesn't want to go to Nineveh to preach, because he doesn't want them to be saved. Jonah hates the people of Nineveh. He hates the Assyrian government because of what they have done to his people. He doesn't want their salvation. And yet, God has done a big enough work in Jonah's life. He comes out of the well and he says, all right, God, even if I don't want to do it, I'm going to go. And he preaches. And the people are saved. Verse 5 says the people of Nineveh believed God. They proclaimed a fast and dressed in sackcloth from the greatest of them to the least. And then verse 10, it says, God saw their actions, that they had turned from their evil ways. So God relented from the disaster he had threatened with them, and he did not do it. God saves Nineveh in this story. He saves Nineveh. He is gracious to them. There's another story I want to give you. This is story time, right? So this is a story of Rakhti Sophia Loible. There's another story if you're interested in learning more about Rakhti. Rakhti is, this story is in Christianity Today, recently featured. Rakhti Sophia Loible was born into circumstances that offered little safety and almost no voice. This is another summary of her story that's written. Raised in a traditional Thai Muslim context, her early life was marked by poverty, instability, and vulnerability. From a young age, she experienced exploitation and control that stripped her of her agency and dignity. Her value was defined by what she could provide others, not by who she was as a person. It was survival, not hope, that became the central focus of her daily existence. As she grew older, Rakhti endured environments where fear, obedience, and silence were expected. The suffering she experiences was not only physical or material, but deeply emotional as well. She carried shame that was not hers to bear, and she lived with a crushing sense that her life had little worth. She felt God, as if he existed at all, was distant, more like an authority to be feared than a presence who cared. Rakhti's trials were prolonged and unrelenting. Escape from her circumstances was not simple, and resistance often meant greater harm. She learned to endure quietly, internalizing pain, and learning to function without expectation of rescue. In this darkness, she wrestled with despair, asking whether her life had any meaning beyond suffering. What made her situation especially devastating was the absence of hope. There were few voices telling her that she mattered, few examples of love that did not demand something in return. And yet, even in the silence, a deep longing remained, a desire to be seen, known, loved without condition. Rakhti's encounter with Christianity did not begin with power or argument, but with compassion. Through exposure to Christians who treated her with dignity and spoke of a God who suffers with the oppressed, she encountered a radically different picture of faith. The message of Jesus was unlike anything she had ever known. A Savior who entered suffering, who defended the vulnerable, who offered grace rather than condemnation. The idea that God loved her personally, that her pain mattered to him, began to break through the walls that she had built for survival. For the first time, Rakhti encountered a faith that did not demand silence, but inviting honesty, not submission through fear, but trusting through love. I could tell you more of her story. Just like the previous story of Yasser Eric, the conversion was not simple for her. It only increased her danger. And yet, because of God's power to save, he took her from both physical and spiritual death and brought her physical and spiritual freedom from the darkness she was in. Our God is a God who is powerful to save us. That's the story of Rakhti Sophia Loible. And in all of these things, before we kind of bring this home, I want to remind us two key beliefs you have to believe. If there is going to be any kind of healthy outreach where you're willing to have eyes and a heart that wants to move towards your neighbors, move towards your friends, move towards your family members who are hurting, move towards your coworkers, move towards your classmates. These two beliefs have to be here. A belief that God is powerful to save even the people that you would least imagine it. And you also have to believe that God is powerful to save us, or powerful to save us and to use us. Again, remember the story of Jonah. Jonah is the messiest, most foolish, selfish, racist prophet that the Bible shows us. And yet, God does amazing things through Jonah. God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh. No, Jonah runs away, and you would think, oh, that's going to hurt God's plan. No, God actually expands his plan and saves more people because of Jonah's sin. God is way more powerful than Jonah. Jonah's like, okay, I'm going to thwart your plan. God says, no, I'm going to expand my plan through your attempted rebellion. And so in addition to the Ninevites, the sailors get saved as well. If God can use Jonah, he can use you. Let's think about ourselves for a second. God is powerful to save. Save the sailors, save Jonah, save Nineveh. But he's also powerful to save us. Let me ask you a question. How did you experience God's salvation this past year? That's a question, we're not going to spend too much time on it for the sake of time, but I pray that this stays with you. How did you experience God's salvation this past year? This past month? This past week? This past weekend? God is powerful to save you. He will. And God is powerful to save others around you. Do you have stories of others who've experienced God's salvation this year? All of us, I think, need to spend a little time, like I did as a school-aged kindergartner, first grader, second grader. And we really need to get into story time. In the midst of all the busyness and chaos and distraction, we need to spend time thinking more about the stories of God's power. And my prayer for me and for you is as we spend more time on story time, we'll have a greater confidence, a willingness, and a courage to be used by God, because his storytelling, his life-changing power, it's not finished, y'all. It's not finished. He's got more stories to write in 2026. Would you be willing to say, yes, Lord, use me. Use me to write someone else's story of salvation this year. Let's pray.